Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature Captain America, the first Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here at Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
And minute 56 is here, and we're going to start quiet but end big. How are we going to do that?
All right. We are going to dive into minute 56, picking up coincidentally right after minute 55. It's funny how that works. All right. Colonel Phillips tells Peggy Carter that this is the perfect time to keep it to yourself. Peggy exits, hurrying after Steve Rogers, who is packing gear for an unauthorized rescue mission. Peggy catches up, her voice urgent. What do you plan to do? Walk to Austria? Steve, piling clothes into a duffel bag, replies, if that's what it takes. You heard the colonel. Your friend is most likely dead, Peggy says. You don't know that, Steve counters. Even so, he's devising a strategy. If he detects, begins Peggy. By the time he's done that, it could be too late, Steve interrupts, pulling a leather jacket over his Captain America costume. Steve, Peggy calls after him, following him outside. He loads gear into a Jeep, pausing to meet her gaze. You told me you thought I was meant for more than this. Did you mean that? Every word, Peggy says firmly. Then you've got to let me go, Steve insists. Peggy's eyes soften. I can do more than that. Back at the camp stage, the stage manager claps his hands. On stage, girls, 5 minutes. Three chorus girls prep, two grabbing helmets labeled U and S. The A helmet is missing. Where's my helmet? One girl asks. Anyone seen Rogers? The stage manager barks. The scene shifts to a silver Beechcraft 18 airplane soaring over the Italian Alps at night, the Stark Industries logo gleaming on its tail. Inside, Peggy briefs Steve using a contour map. The Hydra camp is in Krausberg, tucked between these two mountain ranges. It's a factory of some kind. Howard Stark, piloting, glances back. We should be able to drop you right on the doorstep.
That's a minute.
Very nice. So I couldn't help but notice there's an airplane in this minute. Hal, have you ever heard yes, of airplanes?
I saw one once. They're the things that go on the water. No, wait, those are boats. Anyway, so yes, a great shot of a Beech 18 here, which was there's a lot you can talk about that airplane. It was a workhorse. It was one of the more built in terms of quantity of airplanes of the period. Came around in the late 30s, like 1937, and they were manufactured all the way up until 1970, which for the three of us does not seem all that long ago, even though it was. They started life in civilian use, but very quickly saw service with all branches in the U.S., certainly the Army, Air Forces, and Navy, particularly, and the RAF, RCAF used them. Absolute workhorses and kind of an interesting sized airplane. It's a light twin. You know, if you're used to flying a Piper Cub or a Cessna 150, it feels like a very big airplane. But if you're used to going on an airliner, an A320, they seem very small. But they were incredibly versatile. When you see here is just configured for, you know, sort of transport and cargo.
I was curious about that. What's your opinion of the, in terms of, you know, range and ability to take punishment, what's your opinion of using this aircraft to fly into enemy territory with, you know, flak shooting at you?
It's fairly sensible. On the one hand, it's, you know, it's smaller than a C-47 or, you know, C-46 or some other, although we didn't see many of those in the European theater, some other sort of transport you would associate with paratroopers. Plus, it's very much a corporate airplane, kind of started life. You can think of it a bit like the Learjet of its day. So if you were to ask me, you know, what kind of utility transport airplane would Howard Stark have as part of Stark Industries? This would probably be first on my list.
Is this about the same size as a Beech 99? I've been in a 99.
So it's going to be smaller than a 99. I'm trying to think. I would have to double check, or one of you guys can Wikipedia real quick, double check the number of seats it can be configured for. The thing is, I mentioned its versatility, and that is it's anything from you have two seats up front and the rest is all cargo to, you know, a single aisle with one seat on each side, like a little mini airliner or some kind of a hybrid. You know, they are, just as you're seeing here, they are used for skydiving. They've had multiple eras. You know, the late 30s, it was your corporate transport. Into World War II, it was, you know, utility and advanced trainer. There was a version called the AT-11, where you took that blunt silver nose, or that sort of that pointy silver nose, rather, replaced that with a glass bomber nose. That became the Kanzen. And that they were using to train bombardiers and navigators and everything else. You made sort of a mini bomber out of it. But again, utility, cargo, light transport, any number of things, both at home and training, and then deployed in theater for any number of those uses. The kind of their third era post-war, as the military service wound down, although they stayed in service, I would say at least into the 60s, then that's the era that continues to this day, the era of the freight dog. And there's a whole world of Beech 18 pilots who have some of the most horrifyingly fascinating stories of flying oddball and, you know, small sort of one-off freight. And if you think about it, you think about, well, I'm sending something UPS and I take it to the UPS store and a UPS truck takes it to an airport and they put it on a UPS, 767, I think they have. Then it goes to another airport. A lot of times the distance between that airport and its destination may be such that there's one more flying leg that you would never hear about. So there's a whole world of small companies that have contracts for things like UPS, FedEx, DHL, all these kinds of things, in addition to just absolute private enterprises that aren't affiliated with one of those carriers, that will then take a load of packages and take them to one or two other smaller airports, and the trucks will come and meet them there. I didn't do this on a Beech 18, but a similar sized airplane, a Britton Norman Trilander. I rode with a friend and spent a day with him and flew this weird three-engine British airplane, but roughly equivalent capacity-wise. And this whole company exists so that this one airplane could fly from Boeing Field in Seattle across the water over to Port Angeles, drop off a bunch of packages, sit there for about 4 or 5 hours, and then pick up a bunch of UPS packages and take them back. And you walk out of the UPS ramp and there's your 767s and then one little airplane. And so that happens all over the place. And then one last thing before I'll let somebody else decide to talk, if anybody wants to, the fact that you don't see this nearly as much, but for, I don't know, decades, these airplanes would have been overstuffed with canceled checks and flying all night, overnight, from here to here to here, picking up checks, moving that stuff around. You know, something, you think about something that has to be physically transported, it's got to be done fairly quickly because banking is a timely endeavor. And, you know, the freight dogs who flew these airplanes are famous for either being willing to fly into terrible weather or flying into terrible weather, maybe sometimes against their better judgment because of the pressures that are on them. That, of course, has gotten a lot better. But in the heyday through the 70s and 80s, it was amazing.
So there's like there were a bunch of planes going from the Appleton, Wisconsin airport to make sure that all these checks got to the service center in Chicago by the next morning. It's amazing right. to think about.
and
pre-FedEx, yeah.
And, you know, and you would see these things used for everything, you know, weather modification, fishing support, you know, skydiving, as we're seeing in this minute, you know, still popular for that. One of those handful of airplanes is just an absolute workhorse. And even, you know, even now the airplane is, and next year, the first flight will have been 90 years ago. Wow. And there's still plenty of them flying and they're still out there working hard.
Oh, it's a darn beautiful machine too. It's pretty, it's graceful. For my mind, not knowing much about aircraft, but just seeing Howard Stark flying this thing, it's like, oh, once again, they're kind of reinforcing that whole idea that this is, he's Howard Hughes, you know?
Right.
He's piloting his own craft, and it's a stylish craft, and it's got a little pizzazz to it. And
yeah,
yeah,
the
it does
fact
look
that
like
it's
the
all shiny and
it looks like
it's a
the
good
sister
choice.
ship of the H-1. You know, I think the
It's a good choice.
were they still making radial engine versions of this in 1969? Is that, I mean,
Yep. Oh, yeah. It was built. In fact, from the factory, they were only ever powered by radials, and there's been a number of modifications. And they get stretched, and the engines get beefed up, and they quite appropriately, as the vast majority of them were, was a tail dragger. So two main wheels under the engines, and then a little tiny wheel in the back. So sitting on the ground, it sits in a nose up attitude. But there were some that were converted to tricycle gear and had big pointy noses put on them. And it's a testament to the airframe, you know, whatever your opinions on taking something this pretty and then kind of making it into something that looks very different. It's a testament to the airframe that it's that was and is that versatile.
There must be, I guess, in Oshkosh in the summer, there must be a Beach 18 group that comes in as a wing. Do they ever do that, or
Once in a while? I mean, you tend to have the military versions, the C-45s and the AT-11, that bomber variant, bomber trainer variant. You know, they tend to sort of congregate together and go into warbirds, the civilian ones and their, you know, golden age paint schemes, or the all shiny natural metal like Howard's, kind of tend to gather where they do. Certainly the most noticeable Beach 18 we see at Oshkosh every year is flown by somebody I'm very proud to call a friend, Matt Youngkin, who follows in his father's and his family's footsteps as an air show pilot. He's got this absolutely breathtaking, beautiful red and black Beach 18. So you imagine this airplane in this very striking color scheme. And, you know, this is an airplane. This is a hauler. This is a small airliner. It's a cargo thing. You know, this is a 26 foot sort of U-Haul truck of the airplane world. And I mean that in a very nice way. But he does an absolutely spectacular and beautiful and graceful full aerobatic routine in that airplane.
Wow.
And it's the equivalent of seeing that U-Haul truck, like you're going to a NASCAR race and here's all the cars. And wait, why is this truck out front? Why this truck can drive, it can go in a circle around a track, but obviously it's not supposed to be doing this. And that's what happens when you see Matt flying the airplane. He does his night routine is just spectacular. You know, it's lit and there's strobe lights, pyrotechnics going off all around and all kinds of
things. I got to get out there someday.
Yeah, you really should, Brian. I'd roll out the red carpet for you. And Matt actually dedicates his performance to those freight dogs. He grew up around one, and his dad was one of those guys. And he recently was able to buy the airplane his dad used for all these oddball charter things. His dad carried live dolphins once in the back of the
you a name Star it. Trek IV there.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm picturing a Lao Che Airlines.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Dealing with live poultry.
Very much so. So anyway, obviously a very rich history around the airplane. And you know, I breathed a sigh of relief when I saw it, when I first watched this movie, because it's like, okay, yeah, that one makes sense.
Yeah.
I've never dug too deep into it. It may have a slightly later, like it may be a slightly later variant, have a slightly different nose on it, but even King of the Pedants over here is not going to worry about that.
Yeah. I mean, I assume it's in the movie, it's not a real aircraft. It might be a model, but it could very well just be a CGI.
Nope, very much the real thing. So that is that is definitely air to air. And
How do you know that? Enlighten me.
Well, that's a hard question to answer. It feels unfair to say I can just tell, but there is a lot of that. I guess step one, spend 57.8 years of your life just staring at airplanes and knowing. And yes, the CGI gets better and better. But you could also tell that, I mean, it was shot air to air. As I'm scrubbing through the wrong minute. That's why I don't see the airplane. Shot air to air. It looks to me like it was shot probably with a night filter or it was darkened after the fact. And Jim, we have an open invitation and a positive response, which is we're trying to coordinate schedules to Kevin LaRosa, who did some aerial cinematography on this. And I'm guessing he probably shot this.
Oh, wonderful.
This okay. bit. So at some point when we finally do sync up, we may have to touch back to this minute.
Say, remember or
we
back may find to 56, that
he, yeah. yeah, he may have shot other things. Anyway, I mean, the fact that it's not really doing anything particularly dramatic or fancy. And there's some key things that even the best CGI aircraft, there's key things that animators, no matter how perfectly detailed the model is, there's key things in the movement that they tend to always flub. And you don't see much of that here, but the biggest thing is whether it's airplanes or, you know, pterodactyls or anything else, is animators will sort of select the center of the object. And when they move it around, that's the thing that's moving along the path. And it kind of doesn't matter which way the airplane is pointing. We're just dragging this sort of the center of the model around. And, you know, real airplanes, real flying things are moving through the air. And most of the time, they're sort of going where the nose is pointed. That's hard to articulate without visuals, but
you often see that in CGI of almost anything, like bodies in motion.
Sure.
They don't get the, you know, they're moving the center of mass, but that's not how a body in motion moves. And I think what you're picking up on, if I may be so bold, is the physics just feels wrong to you and you can't quite say why, but looking at it, you say that's not how a plane moves. That's not how Spider-Man would move, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting. Interesting. Really interesting.
Oh. Cool. Wow. I do, switching topics completely, I do notice that this seems to be a Joe Johnston trope, that his heroes, his protagonists always have to have a really cool leather jacket. And seeing Steve getting into that very nice, slick leather jacket, I was thinking, gosh, if only he had giant brass buttons and a jetpack, he could get there in half the time. Yeah.
Well, I think we have a photo of me somewhere on the Cap Minute website in costume. And I cosplayed this one time for a costume party my wife and I went to. She dressed up as Agent Carter, the more, you know, future Agent Carter, in the blue blazer and the red hat. And I dressed up as a Steve. I took a blue t-shirt and I ironed on a star, and I put on a nice leather jacket, got a surplus army helmet, painted it blue, put the A on it. And I love the bit of this movie, or this minute where Steve steals the A helmet.
Easily have been Captain United States.
It's such a funny origin story moment of like, oh, that's how he got the A on his head. He just happened to pick that helmet up off the rack. It's sort of played for laughs, but it's also that, I don't know. It's a neat superhero origin story moment there that Joe did.
Right. And, you know, Howard has a nice leather jacket as well. And that looks to me like an analog to, if not an actual Army Air Force's B-3. And that's what we call kind of all leather jackets. As soon as you get in an airplane, they tend to be bomber jackets. But the bomber crews in particular had those heavier jackets with that sheepskin lining and the big sheepskin collar. He's wearing something at least very much along those lines. And Steve's, I look at, that's a little bit more of a barnstormer flying jacket, or probably more of a motorcycle jacket, but you know, I'm not a motorcycle nerd. That's not my brand.
One can't be everything. I also wanted to pick up on a comment on some interesting interplay between Steve and Peggy in this minute, because Peggy's trying to talk sense to Steve while at the same time encouraging him to go be a hero. And it's an interesting conflict, interesting contrast. It's really one of the few times I can think of where Steve and Peggy aren't on the exact same page about something. She knows he can do it, but she doesn't want him to risk it. She doesn't want him to mess up whatever Colonel Phillips has planned to get these guys out. But we already know Colonel Phillips' plan is win the war, which makes all kinds of rational sense. So she's itching for Steve to be his own man, go out there and be the hero she knows he can be, but at the same time saying, maybe cool your jets just a little bit on this one.
But she's got a personal kind of selfish interest at this point too, that's, I think, is already starting to develop. And I saw that as, you know, she'd never forgive herself if she didn't sort of at least give him an out, or apply a little bit of resistance to say, you know, maybe you shouldn't. But I know, you know, Jim, as we talked about in our last episode, Jim had a lot of thoughts about what Colonel Phillips is really thinking and saying here.
Yeah, I still find this is the strongest evidence that Phillips knows how to motivate Steve to not be a chorus girl by basically mocking him and then telling Peggy to shut up about stopping him. So having him say that this is the perfect time to keep it to yourself, as we did at the opening of the minute, I feel that's the strongest case for Colonel Phillips's reverse psychology methods.
I still disagree, but I really liked Hal's point and about the interplay between Steve and Peggy. And I think what's neat is at the end of the minute, when it's clear that Steve is going, no matter what, Peggy's all in.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
You know, I love that.
And she's good at thinking laterally. It's like, well, Steve, you can't walk to Austria. So, and he's like, no, I can walk to Austria. And he's like, no, you can't.
I'm Captain America. Of course.
Yeah, you can run through Brooklyn, but this is, you know, Austria's a little bit further away. So
well, he does get into the Jeep. He's planning on driving some of the way.
Yeah. Right. So, he might. I don't think they've cleared all the forces out of Italy by the middle of 1943 here. So he might run into some opposition. And I do find it interesting that he is packing his shield. Even though it's the prop and it's not, you know, there's no vibranium involved. This is, right. He probably still has the index cards taped to the back of it on how to sell savings bonds.
But that's a great point because, you know, we see him use the taxi cab door as a shield,
You know, that lucky star. Yeah.
The lucky star, a nice bit of foreshadowing there. And you just wonder, is he that used to it? Does he take that much comfort in it?
Started with the trash can lid, right? So
it's just that.
That's
useful,
right. Yeah.
Something I don't think we've talked about yet in the movie is that this I don't know what shape you'd call that, but the shield you use
bad shape. Yeah.
Is the shield he originally had in the comic books for a few short issues before he graduated to the round one. So at some point they decided that the shield, which looks like the Great Seal of the United States or whatever it looks like, they decided that it'd be more useful to give him a round shield that maybe he could throw and bounce off things and fill his heads and walls.
I would assume it's easier to draw. Is that right, Brian? Would you think that they...
You know, Captain America's shield, the round shield is a tricky thing to draw because it's not just a disc. It's got some concavity to it. Or concavity or convexity, depends which side you're looking at. So you can't just take a compass and start drawing circles. You've got to give it that roundness that it has. So the round shape is tricky, but probably just in terms of ease to draw, I think this original shield would probably be easier, but not as dynamic, not as useful. And so I don't remember how many issues, but back in the 40s, Steve gave up this shield he's using this minute and graduated to the round one.
I've always had a problem drawing those 30-degree five-pointed stars. That's getting the angles right on that. I would think I would probably just get a stencil and just start. Here's a good one.
Just trace it and put it in. But that's another great, great nod to the comics and a great way, for us to see him in that original classic costume.
Yep.
You know, even though it's, you know, we mock it a little bit because he's on stage. He's a chorus girl, as Colonel Phillips said. But like we've said before, it's still, it doesn't come across as they're not making fun of the comics. They're not making fun of how that looked. They're just saying, here's a way to put this in. And now we're going to, from that as a starting point, we're going to edge it into something that's acknowledges later comics and becomes a bit more practical, a bit more realistic.
Yeah. Yep. This is another place where our friend James Payton would have been in the scene while they're, while the chorus girls are looking for the one girl's looking for her helmet, Hitler was supposed to be in the background reading a paper. So he didn't get to be a part of all this. you can never have enough Hitler in your
right.
show.
Well, do you just wonder about that? Like how, like I understand we got Hitler stateside, but you know, would you send Hitler, in costume out there? Is that just a little bit dangerous?
Like John Lita said, it's all part of the show.
It's all part of the show, folks.
What's the show without Hitler?
Yeah. But you just think, it's like, yeah, I'll dress like that in Sheboygan and Poughkeepsie, but I just don't know if miles from the front, if that's a place to be walking around.
I'll bet he took the mustache off before he went,
went from backstage. Before he got on the airplane.
Kept it a little harmonica case or something. Yeah. But also wearing the uniform is probably not idea to have a giant swastika armband on stage in front of a bunch of soldiers.
You think whoever took the shot would probably be forgiven. We get it. I mean, this is pretty much what we trained you to do.
Probably would have been heavily tomatoed as we saw them.
Next time, don't kill the actors.
Yeah. We go through so many Hitlers. Wow. Well, this is a
like drummers in Spinal Tap.
Exactly. Wow. Well, this has been another exciting minute. I really, I've enjoyed this minute and many more to come. We're getting into the act. I mean, I know we've had action before, but I keep feeling we're going to be getting into the heavy action thing. So this is the last time we get to take a deep breath before, we jump into the darkness below. But that's coming up in the next minute. But anyway, thanks for joining us on this particular episode. If you want to continue the conversation, you're always we are always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. And remember, if you do like our show, please don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. It really helps us if you just please put as many stars or check marks, whatever they have on your particular podcast catcher. That always helps us find more people to listen to us. Also, please check out our website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.